Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 Minutes, packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now, and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Please stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers, and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It is Thursday, the 26th of September, and on our program today, in the wake of the big freeze at the weekend, is our Disaster Management Act actually working? Risk planning in an age of climate change crisis. A new report shows just how much money the top dogs at big companies are taking home. And could there be an upside to problematic dump sites? An expert weighs in. Now, there is a chance of more snow to come this weekend, and serious questions are now being asked about our Disaster Management Act and our ability to manage a crisis such as we saw last weekend in KwaZulu-Natal and in the Free State. There is a general sense, I would contend, that authorities were perhaps behind the curve when it came to immediate and effective response. Well, front and center of this debate is political writer and commentator Sandile Swana, who joins us now. Sandile, in your opinion then, what specific shortcomings in the Act contributed to a lack of preparedness, particularly on the N3?
You know, there's a lot of criticism of the Act. My first problem is that, you know, I started getting exposed to the Act in around the year 2007, when we were teaching the minimum competency requirements for municipalities. Over those years, it's 21 years later now, it has been difficult to find a disaster management center that is fully equipped for any type of potential disaster in terms of the Act, let alone that the Act has got shortcomings. The Act, as it was written, my information is that the nation as a whole never complied to the Act as it was written. Then the latest survey showed that the early warning systems have not been designed correctly. So, for instance, you know, you need those long-term weather predictions. In this case, we're talking about the potential snow. We have the technology in the South African Weather Services. That information needs to be communicated to municipalities, local and district. But the question is whether when it gets there, do you have the competent people to actually attend to it? The minister has actually made it clear, Minister of Local Government, that they are short of human resources. Some of these disaster centers are actually one-man shows, who doesn't have all the competences required, nor the equipment, nor the money to do the job.
So it's a competency issue, but to what extent is the current funding model also contributing to the issue?
The money is not there. So that is why you find that the actual equipment, for instance, Jeremy, you will be aware that there are nations such as the United States and others where snow, and they've got worse snow than us, it does not stop the road from being used because they apply the correct technology and the correct competently trained people to deal with the situation and keep cities running and keep motorways running, etc. And even in icy conditions, much worse, much far, much worse than this. We're nowhere near that. I have been locked down by snow in KZN before. I'm talking about 1996. Till today, they don't know how to keep the motorways open.
So how then do you think the Disaster Management Act needs to be amended, Sandile, to ensure better resource allocation, as you've mentioned, one, to prevent the arbitrary use of funds, and two, to improve competency?
So the first thing is that We have a proper risk management framework in South Africa under National Treasure, which basically says that you must prevent the risk, and then secondly, you must minimize. If an event like a snow actually happens, then minimize the potential loss of life and damage to assets. So your funding needs to say that you have a central control of this thing, so that a person or an entity that has got an overall view to know that in Underberg, if there's a risk of snow, these are the people that have got total control of aid in terms of food, vehicles that can clear the roads, all of that. At the moment, it becomes so disjointed, and the pace at which you can declare a disaster is also a problem. So all of those things need to be corrected now. And proper use of the early warning systems with the technology, some of those technologies, we already have them, but at a local level, we don't know how to use them.
And the impact, as we saw this past weekend, can be tragic with two fatalities. But Sandile, let me suggest to you that this is probably low down on the list of national priorities. And I'd also suggest to you that there probably, while the technology might be there and even the money might be there, there probably isn't the willingness or the appetite to make any change.
So the stated differently, what you are saying is that you don't have the leadership in South Africa to get any job done, whether that job is at Home Affairs to get IDs out or anywhere, because all of a sudden you have the GNU, all of a sudden in 90 days things get done. So we have had the wrong leadership, the wrong senior management for the longest time. And without changing that, rushing to change laws is not going to change the problem that you have not been doing the job itself in the first place. And that we need to get people who get the job done in the first place. The guidelines are there, because you don't just use the Disaster Management Act alone. There are other guidelines that actually can put you in the right place if you want to be in the right place.
So who do you think needs to take the lead on this as far as change is concerned? Is it a provincial initiative, or does national government need to develop a backbone here?
This thing we're discussing, the protection against disasters generally, most of these disasters, other than the health disaster as such, most of this work falls under the local government, Minister Hlabisa of the IFP. And he has already told us, because he has read and he has made pronouncements on the review, that actually he has listed the things, the early warning systems, the lack of money, that the money is not being put in the right place, the preventive measures are not being attended to, and the equipment does not deal with the risks. For instance, there's climate change. You can't think you're in 1960 or 1970 today. So all your preparations must take cognizance of the challenges that are relevant today in the various geographic areas.
And Sandile, part of the problem is, I assume, a lack of legal and accountability mechanisms when municipalities fail to comply with the requirements of the Act.
Yes. If you were, Jeremy, if you were to ask for a list, and I doubt if you'll get it, any municipality, wherever, even Joburg, any municipality, of the court orders that have been ignored by the municipality, court orders for the past 20 years, it's a pile. So you get even things, sewage that is unmanaged, all sorts of things. They ignore court orders, no consequences. That is the problem. So you need top leadership, including the state president, who is able to say no life. Right now, there's a lot of prayers and other things that go on about the people who lost their lives. We're not talking to say scientifically and technologically should those lives have been lost. And nobody's going to be held accountable for failing to do what was even mandated in the law ahead of time.
Okay, that's where we are going to leave it. Political writer Sandile Swana, I appreciate your time. So is there an optimum way, as we stay with the story of risk planning for weather events such as we saw last week? I've already said there is an opportunity or chance that we're going to see more inclement weather this coming weekend. How can companies be more proactive, and who takes charge? Well, Volker van Verden is risk principal at RiskoNet Africa and joins me on the program now. And Volker, to what extent then have these recent extreme weather events highlighted, in your opinion, the need for better or improved climate risk planning?
I think to a large extent, because risk management should really avoid being taken by surprise. And weather extremes and climate change have been on us for at least the last 10 years. And what we haven't done is thought about the greater volatility and variation in the weather. So when we have a severe snowstorm like the past weekend, we have these emergency shutdowns that I think are actually too little too late.
So what it's also done is it's highlighted vulnerabilities in terms of South Africa's infrastructure in the face of these extreme weather events. How do we get around that?
Yeah, the infrastructure part is difficult. I mean, roads are roads and they're there for a reason. The part about the use of the infrastructure, I think, is really where we can be a lot more proactive. And there, you know, the weather system was known at least 2 or 3 days before it hit the Drakensberg. So what happens is that significant low pressure develops. These things can be measured. We know exactly what the depth of the cloud, the moisture levels, the freeze levels are known. So what happens is that that system would have had a freeze point at about 500 meters. And as the air is pushed up over the berg, it goes obviously into sub-zero and snow forms. These things are known to forecasters and we should measure that. We know the size of the cloud system and we can estimate the amount of snow and rain that it'll bring along. Those are the kind of things that are not being done sufficiently. And here I have a call out in terms of infrastructure management, whether it's the crisis center management of KZN, et cetera, as well as the toll operators. They should be more aware and do earlier forms of risk and checking of the infrastructure. So we should have been limiting traffic at Mooi River or wherever a day before this massive system hit us, because we knew that it was going to cause a lot of snow at least a day in advance.
Do you think this is an issue of a lack of understanding or just simply an unwillingness to do it because we don't have the capacity or the wherewithal?
I think it's both, Jeremy. The lack of understanding is that we aren't projecting and fully interpreting weather systems. The volume of moisture in the air now that we have climate change is a lot more. The volumes of moisture go up, which means there's more snow and rain and then increases the severity of storms. And then if you look at it, let's say you've got a risk manager or a crisis manager at anywhere, at KZN or wherever, the toll operator. Now they have to make a decision to close the road or limit traffic. And you've got 10,000 trucks up and down that road. And there'd be, you know, bedlam if someone made that call and said, how dare you close the road? We've got urgent milestones to meet. You know, we're going to hold you liable for delaying our trucks. So it's a big decision. But the point of that is exactly the issue. If we don't confront those scenarios and work through those scenarios and saying, look, the road's going to be closed anyway for snow. The fact that we're shutting you down now is for safety, and you would have faced the same 2 or 3 day shutdown irrespective of our actions. Those are the proactive steps. And then you talk to the major logistics companies and you start talking about traffic alerts to the public. And then maybe you only allow a couple of 4x4 vehicles through and so forth. So that kind of planning is just absent. So that's the misunderstanding and the lack of planning and skill that's applied to this environment.
And Volker, what informs that planning so businesses can ensure that their supply chains remain resilient?
We should have a national weather monitoring service that puts out informative alerts that says, hey, here is a major frontal system. It is going to drop 100 or 200 millimeters of rain, whether it's a Western Cape flood or it's snow on the mountains and so forth. And these things are known. They are measurable. But we're not getting to that point through a national weather. And then that can be coordinated with the big truck operators or even traffic management. And then you can decide how much traffic you can allow in the snow on the road and at what time you're going to do it. And that's the service that's missing, or at least the action that's missing at the moment.
And that's on a bigger scale, but perhaps on a slightly smaller scale, businesses themselves, what do they need to start doing immediately to make sure that they have effective continuity plans to handle the disruptions such as you've mentioned?
Yeah, so if they're critical loads that are going up and down the road, and obviously the N3 is one of those, but the Western Cape is similar, and you have this issue and you know the weather's coming, you've got to make a decision. And I think the issue of weather modeling and being alert to weather, extreme weather situations is now front and center on your daily watch. So your logistics manager or your scheduling manager must actually be aware and sign off clearly when these things happen. And it only happens once or twice a year. But it's one of those things that you've got to take seriously when the threat is there. And then you move forward. We had the same with the KZN floods up in on the coast. So when these things develop like this and we know the cutoff low is developing or a major front is coming, a different set of decision criteria come into play, and that's what business should be doing.
And do you think the risk community is embracing this sufficiently? We wouldn't have been having this conversation probably maybe 3, even 5 years ago. Now it seems to happen with alarming regularity.
Well, the events are happening. I don't think the risk community has actually got up to speed yet, because we had a similar conversation in a forum of risk managers. And, you know, we had the point of, oh, you know, climate change and severe happens to us. Now, what is us mean? In fact, it happens to our entire supply chain. So there's minimal, if any, modeling of severe weather impacts throughout the supply chain. And when you start realizing what it means, I mean, if we could have a 100-kilometer-hour wind in a harbor and it knocks over the crane, that's the beginning of your supply chain, because that's when your ship is arriving, or it closes the harbor for a week or two. Now, there could be one-off events like that, or severe events that change the capacity of a harbor. None of that modeling is actually taking place when it's critical to your supply chain.
And that's where I am going to leave it. Volker van Verden from RiskNet Africa, I do appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And this is one of the top stories on our website today. The top 5 executives at the financial services group Discovery Holdings receiving total remuneration of 205 million rand in the last financial year. And despite being group chief executive, Adrian Gore receiving the third highest remuneration of 30.7 million rand during the 2024 financial year. And against that backdrop, the new Kokkela Director's Remuneration Report 2024, which provides an analysis of executive and non-executive director remuneration for around 220 JSE-listed companies and 6 state-owned enterprises, shows that CEO total remuneration experienced a reduction in 2019-2020, obviously due to the COVID-19 pandemic and lockdown restraints, but then an uptick. I'm in conversation now with the MD of Kokkela Remuneration Advisors, Lawrence Grubb. A very warm welcome to you, and in the briefest possible terms, just explain to me how you conduct the survey.
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Thank you for the opportunity. Jeremy, we extract all the data from the annual remuneration reports that are published by companies in their financial statements every year. And they are obliged to publish the details of the remuneration of all their top team of executives or directors, as well as non-executive directors. And so we capture all that data together with performance criteria related to the company.
Mm. Now, 2019-2020, obviously anomalous because of the pandemic, but by what percentage then did CEO total remuneration increase through to 2023, the period of your survey?
Yeah, well, starting off the low from 2019, the increase was about 10% per year for the CEOs, and CFOs was about the same as well. So there's certainly been a healthy increase in the pay, but one needs to know that increase was almost exclusively bar some small percentages to the guaranteed, all in the variable pay. In other words, the short and the long-term incentives, which is to my mind anyway, at least good in the sense that it's related to the performance of the company and not, you know, necessarily huge 10% increases to the guaranteed pay.
How do you break this down sectorially, if you can?
So what we do, and it's very important, because different industries pay differently. And the interesting thing is that industries like basic materials, consumer goods or services tend to be much larger companies. And so when you look at their pay for the CEO on the guaranteed pay side, typically they paid higher than the rest of the industries. But one mustn't be confused then, because that's not necessarily an industry thing rather than a size of company thing. But certainly when you look at the variable pay, you can see that, you know, basic materials and financials tend to be the highest payers in the variable pay aspect.
Do you also look at lowest total remuneration?
For in terms of the organizations?
Yes.
No, we don't. We haven't started capturing that because that hasn't been published yet. But yes, in terms of the new Companies Act, it will be.
And Lawrence Grubb, what about length of service for chief executive officers? Your study, I see, also goes into that. Has that changed from 2018 through to 23?
Jeremy, yes, there's been a big change. And I think that's quite an important thing, because part of the increase could well be from the number of new executives being bought in to run these organizations. Prior to 2018, we used to have a significant number of people, of CEOs, that had been in the company for 6 years or longer, about 51%. After, for the last 6 years now, we see that only 18% of the CEOs have been in their companies for 6 years or longer. So there's been a fundamental shift in terms of the CEOs of JSE-listed companies from, you know, the old guard maybe to the new executives taking over, the new team taking over. But one must remember that every time you buy in a CEO, you're invariably having to buy that CEO at a premium. So that also can be a cause for the 10% increase in the CEO's pay.
Also, I'm wondering whether the complexity of an organization and the associated risk with that affects the pay of a chief executive, total guaranteed pay in any way.
It does a lot, Jeremy. And one of the big things that we need to understand is that because executive pay is linked to the size of the organization, because as organizations grow, they, as you said, they become more complex, they operate in different jurisdictions, they have many more different operations, people, et cetera, et cetera. So as they grow, so does the remuneration for the CEOs or the executives. Now, that's not the same as for the people at the lower end of the organization. Their jobs and the salaries do not grow in line with the size of the organization. So when we talk about a pay gap, and we say we must try and narrow the pay gap, I personally don't think that's possible, because over time, organizations should and must get bigger and bigger. And hence the pay of the top levels will get bigger. But I think what we can do is to try and do the best we can to elevate the remuneration at the lowest level. So to try and increase the lowest levels pay to a living wage, but not at the expense of employment. We've got way too many unemployed in the country and without a hope of getting a job. And we certainly don't want to be increasing pay for the lowest levels at the expense of having to get rid of a number of the lowest, you know, paid workers for that.
And Lawrence, the numbers that you've cited, particularly in terms of top-end pay, are you in any way able to benchmark this internationally, or do you not do that?
We do look at it, you know, in many cases, because obviously we advise clients on their remuneration, and many of them are multinational, if not global, organizations. And so we do end up benchmarking against, you know, other companies from the UK or USA, et cetera, Australia. But, you know, the thing is with our currency, once you divide by 20 or 18 or 17, whatever it is, the numbers look quite small. And that's the strange thing. So while you know, our remuneration here for executives in rands looks to be significant, when it comes into Australian dollars or pounds or US dollars, it's actually below the median. It's significantly below the median.
And just finally, we've been looking at executive positions, but what about remuneration for non-execs?
So non-execs, they've had sort of a more of a steady kind of increase. What's interesting there is that, you know, they didn't really drop during the COVID times because their pay is not really linked to performance. So they kind of continued to get their steady increases. Non-executive chairman as well, they've seemed to have a steady rise, except we had a bit of a drop in 2022, and that was largely because of some anomalies in terms of who resigned as chairman or moved out as chairman. But what's also very interesting is many people haven't heard of a lead independent director. And the lead independent director is almost the same as a deputy chairperson, mm-hmm. who's often designated to take over from the non-executive chair. Or in the case where the chairman is not a non-executive or independent, rather, sorry, is not independent, then the lead independent director will play that role. And that the pay for LIDs has been growing significantly as companies, I think, try and understand this role and attach a value to it. And that's often determined by, you know, who you can find in the market that can play that role.
I'm going to leave it there with my appreciation, Lawrence Grubb, MD, Kokela Remuneration Advisors. I do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And let me finish with this item. The decline of the country's landfill sites have been widely reported on. These dumping sites, if not managed properly, obviously pose massive health and environmental risks, particularly to surrounding communities and settlements. Now, Esme Krombolt is the Group Technical Director at EnviroServe, and she is close to this very important debate and joins me now. And firstly then, Esme, thank you. And what are the main environmental and health hazards, in your opinion, that are associated with poorly managed sites?
I think a site that's not managed properly could have, is we look at potential environmental impacts, we look at air quality impact, we look at odor impact on the community, we look at health impacts on the community, we could be impacting on the groundwater, and then we could just be a nuisance to the community where such a site is situated. So overall, such a site would impact and could impact on all the environmental impacts around that facility.
And Esme, give me a sense in South Africa of how well or how badly these sites are currently managed.
We probably have a mix of these sites, and what we see, the privately owned landfill sites are normally the sites that I would say is better operated and better controlled, and also probably better policed. And if you look at a recent study that a team from AfriForum did, it was actually very interesting to note exactly what I've just said, you know, private sites better managed. And a number of the sites managed, owned, operated by municipalities, not well operated. And I don't want to just make a general statement. There are facilities operated by government that are well operated. But as a general rule, there's a large number of those sites not well operated.
And in that respect, Esme, where do municipalities fall short?
I think the one thing could be funding to do what they need to do. And the second thing could be the know-how, the knowledge, how to properly operate these facilities. But then also there's so much support that they could gain from provincial government and national government, where there are teams with the expertise to support them in the case where they don't have the local expertise to do so.
Do you think this is one of those issues that tends to just fall off the map, given so many competing problems that we have in this country and that we are ignoring it to our detriment?
Unfortunately, I think your statement is correct, Jeremy. I think the issue is that waste is a grudge purchase for people. You know, it's something that they don't really want to spend money on, and they don't see the value in spending the money on it. And I think often could just be forgotten. Mm. And with that, it does actually need the increased focus, because money you don't spend today is definitely going to have an impact tomorrow. Because a landfill site, if you operate it properly, I always refer to them, people say, I talk, it's almost like people, but they're forgiving. If you operate them properly, they run properly and they don't impact. But if you operate them poorly, over time, that impact actually gets worse.
So let's talk a little bit now about the redesign of dump sites into sanitary landfills, how it would help pollution, improve safety, and how difficult it is to achieve that.
Now, I think there's a couple of different aspects to consider. I think you talk about dump sites, and then you talk about sanitary landfills, and then I think we're on the topic of green landfilling. Now, A sanitary landfill site, a well-operated sanitary landfill site would be a site that is designed, constructed, and operated in terms of our current waste regulation requirements. There's a set of requirements issued by a government which we all have to comply with. And in context of that, if you're constructing compliantly and operating, you'll get issued a license by the either provincial or national authorities to operate that facility, and then you've got to make sure you comply with your license. And in that context, you should operate a compliant landfill site. But what green landfilling is doing, it's taking it a step further. It's taking a compliant sanitary landfill site, and it's saying, let's turn our landfill sites into sustainable facilities. And in that context, it's not just something that we're complying with the local legislation, but we're saying, what are the additional steps that we can take that landfill site actually contributes, to sustainability?
And what are those additional steps?
Okay. Now, if you look at typically a landfill site, and your first question was, what are the impacts of such a site? And if we can quickly look at the impacts, the one would be impact on groundwater, with effluents and stormwater and leachate being generated by your facility and potentially leaving your facility. You could be generating greenhouse gas coming off your landfill site, and typically you could be emitting odors coming off your landfill site. Typically, what a green landfill would do is, we know a landfill generates landfill gas, and which contains quite a high percentage of methane, which is one of the greenhouse gas emissions. Now, typically what a green landfill would do is, you'll cap and close your site, you'll capture that gas, and if possible, you'll even turn that gas, either flare it or turn it into energy. So instead of just emitting the greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, you capture and you utilize, giving something back. Now, if I can secondly, for instance, take leachate, which is a byproduct that gets generated because of the biodegradation of waste. What we would typically do, that leachate will be collected on site. It would be treated through a leachate treatment plant, and that plant would be producing usable water. So either that water could be used on site. So instead of using fresh water for certain activities on site, you can now use this water generated by the treatment plant as an alternative water source. And another potential benefit that you could create is, as you finish phases of your landfill site, is to cap and close and renature those areas. Because then, in terms of biodiversity, we could be giving areas back to nature. So there's a couple of these things that we can do to really turn the site, instead of being a nuisance in a community, rather contributing to long-term sustainability. And last but definitely not the least, if we look at our communities that live close to these facilities, if they had a greenfield landfill site in their vicinity, it would be creating jobs for that community. It would be procuring from that community.
All right.
It would be not causing a nuisance to that community.
I am going to leave it there with my thanks. Esme Gombolt, Group Technical Director at EnviroServe, thank you very much indeed for throwing some light on what is an important environmental issue. I do appreciate your time. And that is our program for today. Just before I bid you farewell, on our last online poll, we spoke about the 100 days of the coalition government, or the government of national unity. And I asked you if you were happy so far, if the jury was still out, or if you doubted it would hold. 39% of our respondents saying they're happy so far, but 42% saying the jury is still out, and the remainder saying, well, they have concern that it is going to hold. If you have a view on this one, please get in touch with us via X or LinkedIn. And My question is, are you confident in South Africa's disaster management response? That was our lead story today. And very simply, a yes, a no, or needs a complete rethink. As I say, you can participate in that poll either on X or on LinkedIn. That is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.